You're listening to Security Squad, Episode 4 for June 2008, SQL injection attacks, secure software development, and the rise of managed security services.
If you look at the way or the number of security breaches we've seen in the last, 18 months to 2 years, I think it's pretty clear that a lot of these enterprises don't have a great handle on their data anyway.
Are companies giving up proprietary data in the hands of these vendors then?
Yeah, I think it comes down to the fact that if you're a company and you decide to outsource, you just have to do a good job of vetting your provider.
The vulnerability scanning vendors, are they the ones that are really on top of this?
Well, again, the vulnerabilities are well understood. They're nothing new. The question is, how do you go back and how do you repair all that, those legacy applications that are insecure? How do you make sure that your coding practices incorporate security?
Welcome to another edition of Security Squad. I'm Rob Westerveld, and joining me is CertSecurity.com Executive Editor Dennis Fisher. How's it going, Dennis?
Fantastic.
We also have the folks from Information Security Magazine here, Editor Mike Mimoso, and Senior Technology Editor Neil Reuter.
Hi, Rob.
So we're going to get right into it. First up is managed security software, or software as a service. And several companies, including HP, IBM, and Webroot, have begun to offer some of their security products as software-as-a-service options. And Gartner estimates that in 10 years, the market for outsourced security services should jump significantly. Neil, you recently wrote about HP announcing that it would sell a software-as-a-service component. What was behind the move?
Well, Rob, both IBM and HP, which acquired, of course, WatchFire and SpyDynamics, have both now leveraged those application security products into services. And that reflects the trend that you were just talking about. We're seeing not only more interest in services, but a greater diversity of security that is offered as a service. So we're seeing a wide range of application security services. We're seeing website testing and code review from White Hat and Veracode, for example. We're seeing email security offered as a service, email archiving offered as a service, authentication for other SaaS services from a company called TriCypher. There's a startup called Simplified that's going to be announcing some initiatives in the SSO and identity management area. Log management, we're seeing product vendors offer their products as services, and we're also seeing pure play log management services as well.
These are vendors that are going down into the mid-market and going after smaller companies that are more likely to go after managed services?
Certainly that's the case, especially as smaller companies are subject to requirements like PCI. Log management is a good example of that. But also we're starting to see more traction in mid-range and even larger companies that years ago didn't feel at all comfortable outsourcing their security services. Now that the security services are more mature and their burdens are heavier, they're starting to gravitate that way as well.
Dennis, let me ask you a little bit about this. You just came back from the Gartner IT Security Summit. Was that a real hot topic there? I mean, were the Gartner analysts all over managed services?
Yeah, it was a pretty big topic of conversation there as well. A lot of analysts mentioned it. I heard a lot of attendees talking about it as well. And I think a lot of it, as Neil sort of alluded to, comes back to cost. Honestly, it has to do with the softening of the economy is leading to lower IT budgets in general, and security is certainly taking its share of that hit. The managed services, in a lot of cases, can be more cost effective for these companies, both versus buying licenses for, shrink wrap software compared to the managed services, as well as they can a lot of times get away with fewer people in the IT department. If they're using managed services, they don't have to have as many dedicated security guys, which can cut costs as well.
You guys see any foreseen issues with this? The fact that security software is not going to be within the confines of the company systems?
Yeah, that's always sort of been the argument. You'll hear guys say, I'll outsource a lot of things, but I'm not going to let the security go off premises. It just sort of makes them nervous on some basic level, whether they have any real tangible reason for it or not. They'll just, I think it's one of those control issues. I think security guys in general are control freaks, and they don't want to be reliant on some guy in a bunker 4,000 miles away for their security. They want to be able to go and handle it themselves whenever they can. But I think as the offerings have matured over the years, that has become less and less of a valid concern, I'd say.
The security offerings also, they often give the customers the option of retaining a large degree of control and taking a lot of the management burden off the organization. So you still get the cost savings, but you don't necessarily lose the control. For smaller organizations that don't have the expertise, the control issue has generally not been a big issue at all.
And Mike, has Information Security Magazine covered this issue at all? Is this
covered software as a service, but not from the security angle? We covered it from the security questions that you should ask providers who are providing other IT services. So what kind of encryption policies do they have, access and authentication policies, who has access to your data when it's on somebody else's premises. We talked about 7 security questions you should ask about your provider. And those are the things that companies need to think about when they're outsourcing their applications as opposed to outsourcing their security service.
Mm-hmm. And Gartner says by 2018, 70% of all messaging security products will be offered as a service, and 65% of secure web gateways, 85% of security intelligence products, whatever those are. I mean, I don't even know what an intelligence product is. Anybody here have a clue what that is?
It's whatever Gartner says it is.
Does that pretty much cover almost every area of security? What area is going to remain within the company confines?
Certainly, at least for larger companies, they'll generally retain control of their GRC, their overall compliance programs, at a high level. They may or may not retain control of key data protection security products and services because data is the lifeblood. And what you're seeing is what's replacing the old concern about outsourcing security is where does the data reside? Are we going to trust the data off premises? And that's probably a much larger issue right now than actually controlling the security processes itself.
But I
themselves.
Think if you look at the way or the number of security breaches we've seen in the last 18 months to 2 years, I think it's pretty clear that a lot of these enterprises don't have a great handle on their data anyway. They're probably just as well off having some dedicated provider who does nothing but this, handle their data for them if they're, prone to leaving laptops in taxis or leaving unencrypted backup tapes lying around. They might as well have somebody who's a little better at the task handling it.
I think the other thing for companies, for potential customers of these services to look at now, this is an extremely dynamic and volatile market. There have been a whole bunch of mergers of major players. There have been acquisitions, BT buying Counterpane, Verizon purchasing CyberTrust, Perimeter East Security, which is a sort of a rising star in the managed services zone, has been aggressively acquiring other managed service providers. They're on. They say they're going to acquire one company every quarter, and they're pretty much on pace to do that right now.
Are companies giving up proprietary data in the hands of these vendors then?
Yeah, I think it comes down to the fact that if you're a company and you decide to outsource, you just have to do a good job of vetting your provider. Figuring out if your policy matches up with theirs, if they're willing to negotiate with you and accommodate your needs. That's where the real work's going to come if you're deciding to outsource.
In terms of compliance, do regulations such as PCI cover managed services?
I don't think that they do. I don't think that is contemplated in most of these regulations. I think for the most part, regardless of where your data lives, it's still yours and you're responsible for it and its security. So I don't think that takes any of the burden off of the enterprises for the most part, which, I guess that's fair because, it's your stuff. You should be managing it, whether it's you're managing it on premises or, you're letting somebody else handle a lot of the management off premises. You're still ultimately responsible for it.
But these services can help you fulfill certain regulatory requirements. And again, if you look at, say, one of your requirements is log retention, and you don't want to do that on site, somebody can automate that process for you and handle it for you. They can do log monitoring. So if, say, for PCI, one of the requirements for level one merchants is to do daily monitoring of their logs. You either want to bring a tool in-house that will automate that for you or outsource it to someone who's going to do it on a daily basis for you and tell you what you need to be concerned about.
All right, let's move on to SQL injection attacks. Researchers have been tracking a wave of SQL injection attacks starting it was a startling number of websites last month that were compromised by the attacks. They're taking advantage of weak web applications, and they use those sites as a platform to infect visitors' PCs with malware. Dennis, this is pretty old school, isn't it?
It is in a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, going after these wide open web applications is sort of where web attacks started, you know, 10 years ago. Because starting back then and still today, there are so many, I mean, just thousands and thousands of custom web applications out there that in a lot of cases really went through almost no security code review. So there are any number of common coding errors in there. And if you're, you know, your average unemployable Ukrainian hacker, it's a lot more efficient for you to go after these any of these web applications than it is for you to set up your own malware server somewhere, which is easily black-holed by the ISPs or the security companies. And, you know, they can easily identify those IP addresses these days and steer people clear of them. Whereas if you can go and compromise even, you know, as little as 6 or 8 legitimate websites, regardless of what those websites are, and use those to serve malware to users, you've got a much bigger target platform right there, and it's much harder for the security companies to keep people away from those sites, because they're legitimate sites that people are going to visit every day.
Yeah, I was talking to the folks at VeriSign about their SSL certificates and their EVSSL certificates. My point to them was, okay, these certificates tell a consumer that this is a valid website, but obviously that doesn't mean anything when it comes to SQL injection. Their point was that these attacks are too sophisticated, and it's very unlikely that anybody would be, you know, harmed by it. That's what they said.
That's a pretty naive position, I would think. Those certificates, I think, are a lot like audits, where they say at this specific point in time, this site met this level of trust. Just because that was true at some point in the past, it doesn't mean that it's true right now. And obviously, we're seeing it's not true. There are hundreds of stories of websites that have, you know, the little checkmark seal of approval serving malware. I mean, you can find hundreds of them online. There's no shortage of those. So,
is it all that really takes is one little coding error? I mean, PayPal, I think, was one of the websites that was affected by it. They fixed it immediately, but it's still a problem.
Yeah, I've had several researchers tell me that, you know, if they wanted to, in their spare time, they could just sit there and compromise it, essentially any website they picked out. It would just take them a little time, depending on the level of sophistication. But these SQL injection attacks take, you know, they are not the world's most sophisticated attacks. They, you know, they take very little knowledge. It's more grunt work than anything else.
Why do security researchers like Gary McGraw yawn when they hear SQL injection then?
I think maybe it has to do with the fact that these attacks have been around for a while, so they're pretty well understood, but that doesn't mean that they're well defended, if I can make up a term. There's newer and flashier things out there that, you know, terrify people, like, you know, virtualized rootkits or, you know, things that sound really scary. But when you can still get away with these really simple attacks where you're just injecting a little bit of SQL code into a website and all of a sudden you're implanting malware on hundreds or thousands of users' computers, I mean, why go the really technical flashy route when when the basic stuff is still working?
Mm-hmm. Mike, did you have some?
Yeah, I think one thing that's changing with these attacks, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the scale of them. It used to be that SQL injection attacks were one-off attacks against individual websites or individual web applications, and now they're figuring out ways to hit hundreds of thousands with one attack, and that your scalability goes way up, your probability of success goes way up. So I think that's where the change is. I mean, it may be a yawner for Gary McGraw in terms of the technical nuances of it, but I think the rapid growth and scale of these attacks is what's worth attention right now.
Yeah, I think Mike is right on target about that. And we'll still see, and we're still seeing targeted attacks. Those aren't going to end. If you have a particular company that you're after, and the way into that their data is through their application, through their web application, and that's going to continue to happen. But this sort of scale, this shotgun approach, is what sort of waking people up and making them take notice.
The vulnerability scanning vendors, are they the ones that are really on top of this?
Well, again, the vulnerabilities are well understood. They're nothing new. The question is, how do you go back and how do you repair all that those legacy applications that are insecure? How do you make sure that your coding practices incorporate security? And that's why the application vendors, application security vendors, are gaining some traction now. And that's why web application firewalls are considered an alternative to code scanning by PCI, because they understand, not everybody has the wherewithal, the expertise, or the money to hire high-priced consultants on a regular basis to come in and scan their applications, or to go through all that old legacy code. There are going to be holes no matter what, and the holes are going to be there probably forever.
And that sort of brings us into Gary McGraw and secure software coding. Dennis, you had an interview with Gary, and he seemed to offer up a positive view of secure software coding.
Yeah, I think so. He said he was optimistic for the most part. And, you know, it's been, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, I guess, since Microsoft really started talking this up as part of their trustworthy computing initiative, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. You know, they get a lot of flack in other areas, but I think they do deserve a lot of credit for bringing this issue into the mainstream and telling developers and, you know, enterprises that are developing their own custom applications, look, this is something you need to pay attention to. You can't just leave it until after the fact. You need to follow these secure coding practices, and you'll turn out better applications that'll be, you know, more valuable to your customers in the long run. And, you know, although Gary was optimistic overall, he said, you know, we've really just touched the tip of the iceberg in the idea of training developers in this. There's still, I think he said his company had trained something like 10,000 developers in secure coding practices over the last X number of years, which is not even the total number of developers that somebody like, you know, JP Morgan would have in house. So, you know, there's still millions of developers out there that need this kind of training. And it's not happening in the university and college level. It's just not. They're not teaching it. They don't have the time to do it. It's not part of the curriculum yet. I'm not sure if it ever will be, honestly. So it's going to be up to whoever hires these guys out of college or, you know, in their second or third jobs to really get them some intensive, extensive training on secure coding practices.
Are we ever going to see a seal of approval on products?
That's a great question. There's been a talk about that going back, you know, probably close to 10 years now for some sort of like UL Labs, Underwriter Laboratory seal of approval for software saying, you know, we guarantee this code is secure. But I think the problem is that there's any number of problems with that. One is that sort of point in time problem that I brought up earlier where, okay, once the code was written at that exact moment, it met this standard. But as soon as it's deployed, it's being customized. It's in an environment with any number of other applications where the interactions are where the problems can crop up. And also, you'll never get people to agree on standards. There's a few efforts like this out there. SANS has one. But I don't think anything like that is ever going to work on a large scale.
And if we're so far behind in the West in mature economies and in technologically far advanced countries, look at emerging countries like China. And I think it's no accident that this wave of attacks, which originated in China, was mainly aimed at Chinese web servers.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is that the software vendors already have sort of a bulletproof shield in their end user license agreements. Those things, you know, indemnify themselves against any kind of, you know, defects or, you know, security or otherwise in their products. So they're not going to be that eager to sign up for some sort of good housekeeping seal of approval when they've already got, you know, nobody, as far as I know, has ever successfully sued, you know, over a EULA.
If more software remains in the cloud, rather, you know, the way it's sold, rather than being coming out of a box and being hosted in-house, I wonder if that will make it more secure and vendors will begin to start putting more of a seal of approval on it, seeing that it would remain within the confines of the vendor.
That may be possible because I think the main reason would be that software that's hosted in the cloud, so to speak, is it's essentially one instance. I mean, each customer has a separate instance of that software, but it's essentially the same software. So it's not in your, you know, physical environment interacting with your other applications. So there are fewer, I think, problem areas or potential problem areas. We definitely see hosting providers, you know, guaranteeing 5 or 6 nines of uptime. You don't necessarily see security referenced in that, but it may be something that people use as a differentiator going forward as more and more people are getting to that hosted model like Salesforce and, you know, others and, you know, in the security world that Qualys has been on for a long time. It may well be something that they use as a way to sort of differentiate themselves from the crowd.
Of course, I guess on the other hand, there's the risk that a single point of entry can open up a hacker to many, many, many applications and data repositories.
Definitely. Yeah.
There you go, Neil. Always pessimistic there.
I like to think of myself as a realist. Maybe a cynic.
Well, let's move on to our next topic, and that's zero-day flaws. Adobe was recently put on the defensive when Symantec raised its threat condition to level 2, and they warned that researchers were tracking active exploits of a flaw in Adobe's Flash player in the wild. Other security vendors followed. The next day, Symantec lowered its threat condition and issued a clarification saying that after further investigation, the flaw was already patched and attackers were trying to exploit an earlier version of the Adobe Flash player. Mike, what do you think happened here? Do you think researchers overreacted?
Somebody trying to get to the headline first, somebody trying to get some marketing spin out of this one first. It seems on the surface that somebody jumped the gun there. Probably Symantec.
David Leno, he's Adobe's product security incidents. He's of the Adobe product security incidents response team. He thanked Symantec. So they weren't upset at Symantec for raising the threat condition because he said that they work closely with the company. And so Adobe didn't seem to complain.
Gave them a chance to put out a release saying that they had already patched the flaw that they were talking about. Gee, aren't we great?
So what's your take, Dennis? I mean, do you think that researchers jumped the gun here?
Yeah, I think Mike's right. All of these companies have these early warning systems and blogs where they post, you know, urgent advisories and that kind of stuff. And it's a race. They're all, you know, competing for the same number of eyeballs, trying to get their name out there, saying, "Hey, we discovered this. You know, it's super dangerous. You know, abandon all hope now." That kind of thing. And Symantec, honestly, has probably been one of the companies that hasn't done a ton of that in the past. Some others have been much more guilty than Symantec has, but it looks to me in this case, and I've talked to a few researchers about it, and they said, yeah, they, you know, there's no doubt that they just sort of, you know, had a little false start there and didn't realize what they had. Thought it was a little more serious than it was, but you know, that kind of thing is going to happen. I guess in the final analysis, it's probably better to have people be a little more concerned than less concerned. You know, if it turned out to be a lot more serious than people thought, then people would yell at the security vendors as well. So they're kind of in a no-win position there.
Typically, exploits would come out long after a vulnerability was originally discovered, either by an independent researcher or one of the security companies or the vendor themselves. You know, the concern is that, you know, a bad guy finds the flaw first and then exploits it before anybody else has a chance to react to it.
Are the good researchers still doing very well, Dennis? Are they changing the way that they do business in order to keep earning a pretty good living?
Yeah, I think some of them have. But if you're known as somebody that knows how to find these flaws, you know who the good buyers are. And, you know, I've had a lot of people tell me that there's government buyers in the U.S. and elsewhere who will pay several tens of thousands of dollars, you know, $40,000 or $50,000 isn't unheard of at all for a good zero-day exploit. Now, that's a lot more than you're ever going to get from the Zero Day Initiative or any of those other people buying these things. I mean, there aren't that many of those that you're going to be able to sell that way. But if you find one or two a year, it's a pretty good living. But a lot of these guys, yeah, I mean, I just saw a post on Dino Dizovi's blog the other day about this, the first remotely exploitable vulnerability he found, you know, years and years ago. He reported to the vendor, they took their, so he ended up, you know, disclosing it 2 years after the, after he had reported it to the vendor. And that's an extreme case. That doesn't really happen anymore. Most of these guys have, you know, dedicated response teams to get right back to the researchers and say, okay, we'll look into it. We'll let you know the timeline for fixing it. We'll thank you in the advisory, all that kind of stuff. So there's not a lot of that sort of full disclosure, you know, blackmail going on anymore, at least not for the top legitimate guys.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, maybe Dennis, you can help me with this. There's nothing to stop, say, a less than reputable researcher from selling it to a legitimate source and still selling it on the black market as well, is there?
Yeah, no, there really isn't. It all comes down to how much you value your reputation. And, you know, I think once somebody finds out you've done that one time, you're probably screwed. But, you know, if you don't care that much about that, then I think you can definitely go that route once or twice before people figure it out.
Well, that ends this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest news and information by going to our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For Dennis Fisher, Mike Mimoso, and Neil Reuter, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.